Lend Me Your Ears, the Oral Dramaturgies Podcast. The Gallery, interviews with artists.
Hello, welcome to The Gallery. Our guest today is Sami Metcalf, the British representative of the Spanish-based International Company of Dreamers, Sleepwalk Collective. Born out of London's DIY scene, Sleepwalk Collective is renowned for the kind of work which, according to the Scotsman, commands attention with its intensity and shapeliness. In 2011, their show, As the Flames Rose, We Danced to the Sirens, was nominated for the Total Theatre Awards at the Edinburgh Fringe, and the same performance went on to win top awards at festivals in Kosovo, Birmingham and Bilbao. From then on, they have created a series of acclaimed and technically accomplished works whose form is characterized by a distinctive use of speech and sound. In this interview, we hear about how the company's specific way of working has evolved with regard to their interest in form, music, sound, atmosphere, technology, and collaboration with others. We find out about their working process and how they as a company began to adapt to the unforeseen circumstances of the COVID-19 pandemic while keeping a connection to the UK in the run-up to Brexit. Sleepwalk Collective are the associate artist company of the Oral Dramaturgies project. This interview was conducted between London and Madrid on Skype on the 8th of April 2020. So how did Sleepwalk Collective come about, first of all? I understand you went to Rose Bruford. So how did you start working together? And what personal journeys brought you together and personal points of interest?
So the three of us who make up the company, which is me and Yara and Mala, although for the last few years it's predominantly just me and Yara, we met studying European Theatre Arts at Rose Bruford, which is a course which is a mix of theory and practice. It's sort of theory through practice. And it's also a course where you're studying performance and directing and design. We didn't come out of the training as performers or as directors. It was theatre makers. We all had exactly the same training. So the roles that we've fallen into since then, which is where I'm predominantly outside. I don't perform very often. I don't know if I call myself a director because I think the direction is fairly collaborative, but I do a lot of the writing, I do the music, and I'm the outside eye in terms of the process. And we formed the company just at the very end of the course, just because I think, yeah. I mean, it was partly that thing of going, well, we're finishing now, so we've got to do something. But we felt, I think the three of us, we've been responding to the same ideas and interested in the same kind of thing. So it was actually it was a very quick decision. We just figured, okay, the three of us like working together and we're interested in the same thing, so it makes sense to form a company. There wasn't really a deeper thought process than that. And it then took us quite a long time, I think, to figure out what we were doing. So we formed the company in 2006, and the show, which I think was the first one that really felt like it was our work, wasn't until 2010. So we had a kind of four-year period where we were doing a few projects, but just really trying to figure out what we wanted to do and what our work was. So it's by 2010, that's when it really felt like we kind of existed as a company then. And everything then was much faster and more focused. In terms, I guess, of our initial practice, I mean, one thing that's really key is we came out of the DIY scene, which it felt, I guess, was most active between sort of 2005, 2015, even though we were working in, because we formed the company in London and we were in London for a year, but in 2007, we moved to Spain. We tend to make the shows in Spain now, but do a lot of touring in the UK and some of our main supporters like Battersea Arts Centre in the UK. So we're still kind of dividing the time between the two countries, but we were very connected to and influenced by a lot of artists in the UK around 2005, 2010. Companies like Action Hero, Search Party, that whole ethos of you work with what you've got, the idea that we should be learning how to do everything that we can. So we're not just going to be working as performers or as makers, we're also going to be doing the design work, we're going to be doing the music work. We do have collaborators who we bring in occasionally, but we're still working with relatively limited resources. So we have a lighting designer who we bring in for the bigger and more ambitious projects, and we use them as a consultant on quite a lot of the work that we do. But we've kind of taught ourselves as much as we can how to take responsibility for kind of every aspect of the works, and video design as well is something else. I mean, and some of our abilities are fairly basic in those areas, but we've learned to get what we want and I guess work within our limitations as well. So in terms of in relation specifically to sound and music, I'm not really a musician. I had a good musical education when I was very young. Music was always very important to my parents. So my mum was teaching me music from about the age of 3 or 4. And I kind of did play a few instruments when I was young, but I was never technically very good as a musician. And I still don't really think of myself as a musician, but I'm grateful for having been exposed to a lot of musical ideas from when I was very young. And I think I've got quite a good ear, maybe. I kind of developed instincts that I now use quite a lot and that helped me to manage the fact that my, like, from a technical angle, I'm not particularly good as a musician. But I know how to find things because I can hear them.
I was going to ask you what formative influences that might have informed your way of working. You mentioned some of these DIY companies, which I presume might have been the companies that you were becoming aware of when you were a student.
It was actually more, it was kind of straight after we graduated, because I mean the course we did was great in terms of things like creative and conceptual thinking, but it's very much focused, or was when we were studying, on early to mid 20th century up until the kind of 80s, I guess. And it's a lot of European work and a lot of Polish work, focused on the classical avant-garde as well. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the companies who we were maybe directly influenced by at the beginning were essentially our contemporaries. And it was people whose work we became aware of really straight after graduating and coming out of that quite academic bubble, mm-hmm. and running to catch up and see what work was actually being made. Especially artists of our generation, or artists who started working just a couple of years before we were, and people who were making stuff that felt of its time in a positive sense. I mean, obviously, Force Entertainment is a big, because they're a big influence on everyone, mm-hmm. in the UK. Mm-hmm. Melanie Wilson was a really big influence for me. I saw a couple of her really early shows. I saw a show, I think it was just before I graduated, so it would have been late 2005. I saw a show called Simple Girl, which was one of Melanie Wilson's early solos, and was really blown away by it. An aspect of it that was really key, which maybe I only realized later, is sound was really integral to the work. The way she was working with text and with her voice was really important for me. And then I saw some of her, I haven't seen anything she's done for years, actually. Because that's one of the only disadvantages of being in Spain, is it's pure luck when we actually get to see any work in the UK. But I think that was really major.
Very often it comes across as though your area is more to do with writing and sound design, and Yara's area is spatial design, if I understand correctly. Yeah. And then you have these other collaborators who complete the puzzle in some ways as well.
Yeah.
And you mentioned that both of you are interested in sound as the primary means of making. When did you become aware of that as a shared interest?
It kind of happened really gradually, I think. So the first time when we actually did any kind of sound design ourselves was in the show we did in 2009, 2010, which is The Sirens. Before then, we'd just been using music that we liked and just playing music that we liked in our shows. And then kind of started to feel like maybe that was a bit lazy. And also that we weren't tailoring stuff for exactly what we wanted. When we did The Sirens, I still didn't feel confident, or actually it hadn't even really crossed my mind the sound design was something we could really be doing ourselves. So we got one of my oldest friends, who we were living with at that point, to make a couple of pieces of music for the show. And that was kind of us saying, well, can you make something that sounds a bit like this? Because we had other bits of music we'd been rehearsing with. And he made some stuff. And then I made a couple of things just to fill some of the space in between that, and kind of realized that I might be able to do it. And then when we did the show after that, which was Amusements, that was the first time I made the whole soundtrack. I don't know if we necessarily thought that was that significant at that point, but it opened up this whole way of working, which is now essentially what we do, which is where we're always doing everything. Every part of the process is parallel. So we're always working simultaneously on text and on music and on all the other aspects of the project as well. But I'd say especially music and text are really parallel. Whenever there's a new bit of writing, we try to get music for it as soon as possible. Sometimes it goes the other way around. Often it's the case where if I get stuck on something, if I get stuck on the writing, I'll just switch to making some music and see if the music will tell me what the writing should be doing. Because I feel like they're always, music especially tells you what kind of mood you're writing for, what kind of space you're writing for. And so often it really helps me to resolve stuff, or it makes text work that wasn't working beforehand. For me, the relationship between the two, between text and music especially, is really intimate and often indivisible. Even if you have silence with a piece of text, that for me is that's a musical choice. So the interest, it actually happened quite quickly over the course of a few projects between 2010 and 2014 probably was when it really was going, okay, this is how we're working now. And it wasn't necessarily something we were expecting to happen, but it immediately expanded the way we were working and just clarified. And we suddenly, we went, okay, this is what we want to do. This is the kind of work that we want to make. And I think we go through periods of trying to rethink that or try to figure out different approaches. And occasionally we go, well, should we make a show without any music in it? Which we haven't done yet. It's sort of parallel developing the whole of that practice. Yara was also developing her own practice outside of the company. And just because sound was so integral to the work of the company, she was taking aspects of that over into her work. She doesn't do the actual practical work of designing sound. That's what I do. But she does a lot of the kind of conceptual thinking, and she's very good now at explaining what she wants for things so I can make it.
Who is she? This brain turned out. What does she carry inside herself? What is she thinking whilst we are sleeping? Does she listen to our dreaming? Does she care? How much does she fuck with us? Lie to us? Betray us? Force our crying, make us sick? How much is her whole world like a brain?
Sound design has within our work is often it's the music that has the responsibility for building the dynamics into the work, creating a sense of a journey through the show. And sometimes we've done that to a really extreme extent. I remember in Domestica, relatively early in the process, we had 45 minutes of music with all of the dynamic up and down, really before we had any of the show made or written. That became something we could ride on top of. And we did then change quite a lot of the music afterwards and add things and expand stuff. But I feel often the music does the heavy lifting in terms of creating a sense of a journey. It means that things like text can actually be static. It's one thing I think it's funny, sometimes if you read texts, particularly the early shows on the page, there's no real development or movement in terms of the text. The music and the sound creates the sort of illusion that there is.
Do you improvise, like when you are together in a room rehearsing, is there live music going on? And is that an improvisation or is it something you prepared earlier that comes into the rehearsal room?
What I tend to do in terms of making music is I make a whole load of tracks. Each one It's almost like just a loop with minimal development. It will be more or less the same thing for quite a long time. They tend to be about 10 minutes long with minimal variations. It will just be sort of one thing. But I'll make everything basically in the same key. And it will be a mixture of some tracks which are quite dense and some stuff that will just be a drone or a texture. And that means I can live mix different stuff. And that will be something during rehearsals that I'll do a lot. I'll have two, sometimes even three tracks that I can play simultaneously on top of each other. And that way you can build dynamics into a track which doesn't have them by going, you have a first layer that's playing, then you gradually bring in another layer that's playing. So that kind of live DJing is really integral to the process. And also that's how I do the shows live. I always run everything off DJ software. All of the shows have probably between about 15 and 25 different tracks. And I'm mixing one into another live. And it means I can follow what the performers are doing and follow what a particular mood is on a particular night sometimes as well, in terms of when the transition comes and how slow the transition is. There is a liveness to the way we're working in performance and in rehearsals as well, but it's always working with pre-prepared tracks. The other thing also that's worth talking about, which we mentioned in terms of sound design, is microphone mixing.
God, yes.
A really, really key thing that happened for us maybe 10 years ago, we suddenly found this way of mixing microphones, which just works for us. And we still have to persuade theatre technicians sometimes that it is actually what we want. Yeah. First, you take out almost all of the bass, most of the low mids as well, so there are no low frequencies at all. Put the high frequencies up pretty high, way higher than you would do normally. And then put it as loud as you possibly can go. Unless you're in a theatre with really, really good acoustics you can work with, it's almost always on the verge of feeding back. So I actually have to have my hand on the volume control pretty much the whole way through. As soon as you've got multiple microphones, it's a total nightmare. And often I'm having to really quickly just switch them on and off, because if you have more than one microphone on at the same time, with that mix, it will feed back. If you hear it without any music, it can sound really weird, because it's got a weird crackly, doesn't have any bass in it at all. Firstly, that does a weird thing where it kind of goes into your, I realize it kind of goes into your head in a weird way that's different from a regularly mixed microphone. But also the key thing it does is it means that the voice is entirely occupying high frequencies and the music can kill all of the other frequencies. So you can put the voice and the music pretty loud simultaneously, and you can hear the voice clearly.
And how did you discover this methodology?
Again, it was kind of by mistake. I think a lot of stuff we discovered doing amusements, because it was headphones, because it was so sound-based, we kind of had to do that work. And also, it was the first time we were doing something entirely by ourselves, in terms of, it was the first sound design I did entirely myself. And also, some of it I just did it, or I just went, well, this obviously sounds better. I didn't even realize that it was not the normal way of mixing stuff. There was also another thing, which is that we were working with Silent Disco headphones, which have quite a limited range of frequencies that they'll actually do. So we had to kind of do anything we could. It was very easy to sort of overload it and make it distort. So you kind of had to really work to make it so the voice was occupying one space and the music was occupying another space. So I think we sort of were forced to learn a load of things we didn't even realize we were learning at the time, and then realized we could apply it out loud. I think part of it, I mean, Yara gives me shit for this, but it partly is I'm almost entirely deaf in one ear, so I kind of instinctively try to make stuff really loud anyway. I kind of always been interested in sound that you can kind of feel almost as much as you can hear. And getting like a really full bass, especially as well. I was really influenced by one of the Futurist manifestos, which is the Futurist synthetic theatre. Basically, you could sum up as being like, you know, every bit of a show should be the best bit. Like, what is the point in making like a 3-hour drama where really the good bit is the last 50 minutes and everything else is build up? Just cut out all the other stuff. And it was maybe just thinking about art that I liked previously or stuff that I was enjoying rehearsals. Like, I really was just interested in the kind of peaks where it's really loud, where you get the impact. And so I think that I've always, on one level, been trying to make it so you're kind of cutting out the build-up in stuff unless you really need it. It's kind of funny. We're in a point now where actually our work is generally better received than it ever has been. And I think it's partly because we build a bit of an audience who kind of know the work that we make. So it's been really nice that actually stuff like Domestika was generally positively received. And it was kind of a shock for us. I think we still go into everything with this attitude that the work will potentially be hated by someone or just won't make sense to some people. And I think that's encouraged us sometimes to really commit to certain things and take those things as far as we possibly can, because we just go, well, if we're going to do something which is a particular kind of thing, we might as well make it the most extreme version of that. Christopher Bailey said that if something isn't working, try just making the most extreme version of that. Rather than doing the thing you would instinctively do, if something feels too long, you go, okay, we'll make it a bit shorter. Just make it longer. Maybe the longer version is the better version, or the louder version is the better version. Sometimes you need to just push something to its extreme, and that's when it becomes interesting. I think we've kind of committed to that.
Can you summarize what the Sleepwalk collective process is?
Form always comes before content. It's maybe something important. I think we don't tend to really know what shows are going to be about until at the very end of the process often. At the moment, I think we're actively trying to do something new or something which at least feels like a development from the way we worked before. Often we will begin with a very clear and preferably limiting formal structure, formal idea for a show. The idea that that form will present a whole series of limitations that we have to work within is usually really important for us.
Can you give an example by reference to some of the shows we've seen, maybe?
Yeah, for sure. So Karaoke was the one which had the most clear format from the beginning. And the full idea for the show came in about 30 seconds. It would be a karaoke and we would read all the text on the screen, and that would also tell us all the instructions for action, and that also that would be projected so the audience can also see what we're seeing. That was 30 seconds of work. We then worked for about a year or longer on figuring out what that structure could accommodate. Often it's kind of that way around. You have the structure and then the work is figuring out what does that allow you to do within those limitations? And what does that structure want to talk about? It's not that objective or scientific, but it feels like it will propose certain things that thematically it wants to talk about, and also will leave out a whole load of other things.
When you were saying earlier about how you are writing text and music at the same time, presumably because you live together as well, that process is not you in a turret kind of writing on your own. How does the process of writing and making sound bleed into the rehearsal process?
At the beginning, in the same sense that I'm not a musician, I'm not a writer either. And at the beginning, all of the writing was coming out of text improvisation, particularly when we could have multiple performers. And it's something we still use, especially when we're working with students or on collaborative projects. As much as possible, text is coming out of a few really basic exercises we've got for generating text, and it's doing long improvisations of people just talking. I'm noting down stuff from outside, and the actual my writing work is often really editing. It's really just taking stuff that other people have said and editing it and finding ways of filling in the spaces and seeing what ideas come to me through listening to other people talking. That is still a part of the process. It varies a bit depending on the project, but in the last few years I've gotten more confident at actually writing myself, and so now it's a kind of a mixture. And also we tend to collaborate with people we have long working relationships with, and we also write very much for performance. We don't write the text we want to write and then make the performers adapt to them. It's the other way around. We'll sketch bits of text and we'll see how it sounds with a particular performer. And if it doesn't work, we change the text rather than change what we want the performer to do. And often in terms of the writing, we're thinking about the sound of that person's voice and also a whole load of other kind of superficial things in terms of what that performer looks like and what their presence is, for want of a better word.
Can you illustrate this in terms of decision makings by reference to examples? You know, how would you qualify Yara's voice and what does that mean in terms of how you make decisions?
It's less a thought process than it is just something kind of like, you know it when you hear it, I think. I would say our process at the moment is I'll be writing stuff which either has come partly out of text improvisation or now I am also starting an increasing amount and writing by myself. And that's actually partly because out of a desire to shift how we're using rehearsal time away from being really text focused, which we have been for a long time, into doing more visual exploration. I think we're working with a choreographer at the moment on a project, which is the first time we've ever done that. We've really tried to expand, I guess, the visual language of our work. And so that means we're shifting a bit away from using a lot of rehearsal time for working on text and a bit more towards using that time for other things. And that means I'm doing more writing outside of rehearsals, if that makes sense. I often find that if I've got a bit of text, which will usually be incomplete the first time we hear it, I can hear Yara reading something, and usually on the first way through, I can hear the lines that don't work, and I just cross them out straight away. It's not necessarily a rational process, and it's often not even about the content of the text or what it's communicating. It just sometimes I just go, well, that line feels wrong with you saying it. It's thinking almost musically about it sometimes. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's just a word doesn't sound right in mm-hmm. someone's voice. Mm-hmm. Obviously, I think there would be ways we could put more time into going, well, we make this work. We figure, you know, we work when you're delivering, you figure it out. But actually, I usually find it more interesting and more productive just to move past that. Otherwise, you can get stuck on just trying to make a single line work for ages. And often it's more interesting and takes you somewhere new if you just cut stuff and move forward as quickly as possible. It's fundamentally instinctual and musical in terms of thinking and listening. And it's very much about just hearing what stuff sounds like. The idea for the show we're working at the moment is that the scenes will be in a mix of English and Spanish and Czech, and that will be subtitling stuff depending on where we're performing it. Another thing that's maybe significant in terms of our practice is we spent the whole of the last decade making every show in both English and Spanish. And the way the text gets translated between one language or another language often shapes it. But we've premiered most of the shows in Spanish before we have in English. So the process of translation, which Yara does, often is really integral to how the text itself is developing. A lot of the approach to text is just moving stuff around from one language to another language or from one voice to another voice and just seeing what sounds right and thinking about the feeling of the text, and particularly the feeling of the text in relation to music or in relation to an image or in relation to the lighting as well, and running with that particular mood or that particular feeling rather than thinking too much about what it means, I guess.
Why is it important for your work to be in the form of live theatre as opposed to radio drama?
Our whole approach to making stuff, definitely for me, I think Yara as well, is always about putting different things in relationship to each other. Like no element is complete in itself. So in terms of drama, like the text doesn't really exist without the music. They're both leaving space for each other, but they're both also taking from each other to become something more than what they are. And that goes for kind of every aspect of the production. So the relationship between a text and a particular image is more important than either element by itself. A lot of the work that we do in rehearsals, again, this is something which started off at the beginning of our process as being, we were very, I guess, pure in terms of really engaging with particular exercises in rehearsal, and now we do it a bit, the work's become a little bit more cerebral, maybe. I think we spent a long time doing a lot of improvisatory exercises, and now you can kind of do that work mentally a little bit more than we could at the beginning. But we still work with exercises that are just about finding chance relationships between an image and a text and a piece of music, kind of long form improvisation within very specific structures. That's definitely why I'm interested in performance as opposed to something like radio drama, is you just have more things that you can put in relationship to each other. Mm-hmm. We have done versions of some of our shows that are just audio. We did a short version of Amusements for the national radio in Spain maybe 5-6 years ago. We've done some other kind of pieces. I think Yara has a really strong interest in that. I find it a little bit frustrating, or maybe I just get self-conscious about the fact that you're going, you're really hearing the music, and within theatre you can always put something else there. I think also I get bored quite quickly, and even in rehearsals sometimes, once I've heard text a few times, I'm like, okay, I should put something else on stage to kind of make this interesting for me again. I mean, there's another thing which is that, you know, we work in performance because it's what we know best, and we do have the conversations as we go, well, maybe we could make film, or maybe we could make band. It always comes down to the fact that this is the form which I understand to the deepest level. It's like you can skip past all of the preliminary formal questions about how do I actually even engage with this form and get to the kind of interesting and complicated parts of it. There's an answer which is just about what are the tools that the art form gives, but there's also an aspect of it which is just, this is what I know how to do.
There were several things I was thinking about, some ideas sparking off. One was the way in which some of the works we've seen are aware of the presence of the audience. How does that inform your thinking in terms of the presence of the audience?
One thing which was really important for me was there was a period kind of when we were starting out where suddenly there was this huge emphasis, and it felt like it was coming from artists and also from critics, on the idea of theatre as a communal experience and that being something that's really important. Mm. And I found that really annoying. Like, I mean, I enjoy that kind of work, but I kind of don't want everything to be like that. And I'm really interested in the experience of being part of a group but feeling alone within that, or feeling like you're having an individual experience but you're aware of other people who are around you who are having experiences that are different from you. I know from an audience point of view, for example, I love it when I'm watching something and I'm finding it really funny and nobody else. Yeah. Or the other way around. The most sort of extreme we took that to is when we did Amusements. It's in a theatre, so the audience is sat in conventional seating, but everyone's wearing headphones. And that was partly because you get a whole new control over exactly what the audience are hearing. But also it was at that point a very active decision to isolate the audience from each other as much as possible, to make it so there is no contagion at all. It's a very weird show to do because the only person who's not wearing headphones is Yara on stage. So she's essentially in a silent room and can hear absolutely everything that the audience are doing. And some people start singing along and some people start laughing while someone else is crying. That was really exciting to us, this idea that you can really isolate people but within a crowd. And you're kind of aware of that kind of experience. And so that's been kind of an ongoing interest.
What do the audience members actually hear through the headphones?
The whole show is it's just a solo show. It's just Yara in the center of the stage. She doesn't move at all, and her shoes are actually stuck to the floor. She's speaking to a microphone the whole way through, so you're getting her voice right there in your head, and then there's a soundtrack which is mixed underneath that. There is a couple of small tricks where, for example, will switch without anyone realizing to pre-recorded text. So Yara can be speaking and then she takes the microphone away and the voice carries on. Mm-hmm. So we did some stuff like that. But it was a very distinct difference between watching with the headphones and watching without. It's hugely important to me that the work is in a room in front of an audience. And I have a real issue with watching our own videos, for example, and we never film rehearsals, or if we do, we never watch them afterwards.
Another thing is that when the work comments on itself, as it sometimes does in the text, there is this awareness that the work is not narrative-led. It's not drama, I mean, you know, in that conventional sense. And then Domestika gets published as a play text. How did that come about?
It was a combination of things. It was we invited Oberon to come and see the show through a kind of mutual contact we had, so we were able to ask someone if they wanted to come and see it. And it was partly because it took a really long time to make that show, and also it's because I think we were all getting more confident in terms of things like writing. It was the first show we made where I kind of was happy with how the text works on the page. It's different from the version in the show. I feel like it probably makes more sense if you have seen the show, but it was the first time, definitely, I really felt like I would be happy for someone to read this, because we had the option of really presenting it as a script, so saying who is speaking each line and it was important to me that it was just presented as a piece of writing and didn't try too much to kind of replicate how it works on stage, because I think you can never do that. You have to sort of treat it as a slightly different form. I remember Oberon came to see it and really liked it, and then they wanted us to have tour dates set up, just because it makes more sense to publish when this show's happening. And then that didn't happen. And then we got a handful of shows, and Oberon were kind of interested enough in it as a piece of writing. Part of it is just vanity. And the fact that, you know, as we're getting older and you become conscious of how ephemeral the work you make is, and how, you know, we've got shows. I think Karaoke we're probably never going to do again. That show's kind of vanished. And I like that about the work. I like the fact that the stuff just exists for the moment that it does, and then it's gone. It felt like a way for the work to survive a little bit longer, I suppose. Domestika was the first one where that felt like a good idea. Some of the early shows, especially stuff like Karaoke and Amusements, the text only works on stage. It only works in relationship with everything else, with the way the music and the imagery is making space for you to listen to it and hear it, and it on the page just kind of doesn't work. And there is I definitely had a thing that's happened where sometimes we've written something we really liked on the page, and then you do it out loud, and it's kind of lifeless, and you have to actually make the text worse as a piece of writing, in a sense, in order to make it actually work performatively, because text to be spoken and heard out loud is very different from text on the page a lot of the time. And I think we're starting to find a bit more of a balance in between, and I think we're pushing ourselves, definitely with some of the new work we're doing at the moment, we're trying to be maybe more ambitious in terms of the writing, in terms of the kind of density of the writing, and to figure out how the show can accommodate text which is maybe more complex or maybe less performative. But it will still be the case that we'll have a couple of lines that we love and feel as writing it we're really happy with, but they just don't work.
I can watch you all die. It shouldn't take too long. In these heat, and with no water. And until then, for tonight, we'll have to make our own entertainment, like the ancient Greeks did, like the Romans, like our parents always told us to. Find what sparkle and charm we can in a shift of light. In the depth of a pause. In my open mouth. In my open thighs. In my empty face. In my empty eyes. Because tonight there will be no magic, no magical transformations, just the truth in all its banality. and all its horror. And the light will be the light, and the sound will be the sound, and the color blue will be the color blue, and you'll be you, and I'll be me.
How did the collaboration with Chris Brett Bailey come about?
I think we must have met like 6-7 years ago. We had mutual friends, and then we kind of met and then saw each other's work and really liked it. Had that slightly awkward thing where you really like someone's work and you don't know if you're going to get along with them. I think we were really nervous the first few times we met each other, probably. And then that just kind of developed. And this, I played guitar in This Is How We Die a few times. I went into Edinburgh the first time. I've been one of the stand-in guitarists for that when not everyone's available. And I've also done subtitling for that, doing live subtitles, because we've hosted it in Spain a couple of times. Through that, we got a bit of a sense of how each other work. We also had, I think, when we premiered Domestica, Chris was just literally just down the road. We were at BAC and he was at Oval House. He was doing Kissing the Shop Band Goodnight. And so we were really hyper aware of each other's processes at that time. And it was probably around then we started joking that we should make a show at some point. And we weren't serious at all. And that was 2016. And then I think kind of last year, maybe the year before, we actually got serious about it and thought maybe we should. And so we did a kind of secret residency in Spain. It was exactly a year ago, right now. And that was one that we kept totally under wraps. And it was just to see if we could work together, without it totally ruining our friendship. And it went well, and we still were taking it slowly, but we did a few days in London in last July, and then in December we did a full week here, and it's kind of coming along, I think. It feels kind of good.
And how is the swimming pools show different from the one you're doing with Chris?
The way I have been thinking about the last few years is that we kind of have two types of show that we make. We have the shows which we kind of know how to make and the shows which we don't know how to make. And the shows that we don't know how to make, and that's almost a deliberate choice to like not understand what we not know or understand what we're going to do, are usually the ones where we make significant progress in terms of how we're evolving our practices and ideas. Those are the ones which can go wrong, obviously. Ever since we did Domestica, which that was the last sort of leap forward, I think, in terms of our work. In that case, it was a lot of it was to do with being more ambitious with the writing, being more ambitious in really kind of every sense within that project. And the last things we've done since then have felt easier in a lot of ways. I mean, never feels easy, but at least we could take the approach we developed through Domestica and reapply it to new forms and new stuff that we wanted to talk about. Definitely Courtney Kardashian, the last show we toured, felt like it was, we were taking this whole practice we developed and we were making another show. It was obviously a new show, but the practice was only slightly different than the stuff we'd done before. So swimming pools were really trying to do something which feels new to us, even if the show in itself will feel like our work. We're again trying to be much more ambitious in terms of scale, in terms of the writing. We're kind of playing with narrative to some degree for the first time ever. We're working with a choreographer for the first time ever. That feels really key to us. That's partly just because so much of the work that we see and are influenced by at the moment is dance. Mm-hmm. And that's partly just because dance in Spain is really good. There's much less distinction between theatre and dance here. They're not really treated as separate art forms. There's a real kind of fluidity, and most of the people we know working in theatre are influenced by dance and are working with choreographers and vice versa. So this was it's something we're really excited by. That was the possibility of working with the choreographer, and also just expanding our visual language, which is something that we feel we really need to develop. So yeah, swimming pools is kind of all of those things. It feels like it's the riskiest show we've made in a while. It's the most ambitious show we've ever made in terms of the amount of collaborators and the scale and the budget and all of those kind of things. And it's the one where we hope to find something new for ourselves. Whereas the one with making the show with Chris feels much more kind of, it's going to be a smaller show. It feels a show where we're giving ourselves more permission to kind of enjoy it. We don't have to kind of make a big creative leap forward, because that's already happening, because it's a collaboration. Because Chris is bringing a whole load of things that we wouldn't be able to do.
Such as?
We like to kind of frame the fact that our work is non-narrative as, you know, a really clear artistic choice, and it is mostly, but also we don't really know how to do it. Like, we can't really write narrative work. We're experimenting with that at the moment, but it's sort of it's a combination of an actual definite creative choice, but also about dealing with a kind of a limitation that I have in terms of working with narrative, whereas Chris is phenomenally good at working with narrative and making narrative do new things and being really kind of inventive and imaginative and experimental in terms of narrative and how that works on stage. So I feel like I'm already learning a lot from the process with him. It also means that he is bringing a whole new thing into the work that wouldn't be there if it was just us. It's really exciting getting to work with his writing and getting to work with him as a performer as well. In terms of that project, Chris and Yara are going to be performing. I'm outside, but again, not as a director exactly, definitely not as a writer. All the writing we're doing collaboratively between the three of us, and the music as well, which again, that's something new for me, in that it's been a decade since I had a collaborator within a project who was also making music. So far we've been making some stuff separately and mixing some things together, and that feels really interesting. So I think that one is a more pleasurable project. It definitely feels like it's so far, and maybe it's just that we haven't got into the really difficult bit, it's felt really, yeah, it's felt kind of pleasurable and interesting, and stuff has just happened within the creative process just because we have someone new we've never worked with before and who we like a lot. Whereas I think Swimming Pools, we're deliberately trying to make things difficult.
What made you choose to move to Spain?
It was a spur of the moment thing. We spent a year living in London after we graduated and found it really difficult. I mean, I think for everyone it is, but there's a few things we just didn't plan very well. We found it really hard. I think if we'd stuck it out longer, we could have figured out a way of making it work, but we weren't really working creatively very much. We didn't know even really how to begin. And then after a year, because Yara is from Vitoria in the Basque Country, she was able to apply for funding for a really exciting new art project there, which only lasted a few years, but we managed to get funding to make a show. So we moved to Vitoria for 6 months to work on that show, and we just stayed on. It was a really good place to begin working. We were there for years, and it did feel like an accident, but it just, when we got there, it was exactly the right change. It's exactly what we needed after being in London. Mm-hmm. And also, it's still very easy to keep working in the UK.
How will it work out with Brexit?
God knows. Like, we're not thinking about it. The kind of level of disruption is kind of unimaginable at this point, and we don't know. Our producer, Birmingham, is great, and she's been working with international companies for years and years, and she started trying to figure out how to work around Brexit like 3 years ago. So we will have options. We still don't know what's going to happen, obviously. But until now, it's worked. And there has been the odd point where I thought, well, maybe if we really committed to one country, we could have progressed professionally faster. The big thing with being between the two countries is you see and can be influenced by different kinds of work, and it's radically different between the UK and Spain. There's superficial similarities, but the whole ethos is so different. I mean, the UK, it's much easier to be an artist, and there's much more artists, and there's much more, like, a young artist in the UK is 21, a young artist in Spain is 35, because it takes that much longer to get into the profession. and there's far fewer artists over here, and that you don't have the same kind of DIY ethos of anyone can make work, and you make it on your own, which you can. But the difference over here is artists of our generation are much more ambitious. They will make shows with the casts of 80 people because that's what the work needs, and no one's telling you that you shouldn't do that. They're also generally more literate, are influenced by a much wider range of artwork. I mean, it's. I think in the UK it's still the case that there's a lot of artists you can see and they're only influenced by theatre and they're only interested in theatre, and you can tell in the work that they're making. That almost doesn't happen. That doesn't mm-hmm. exist in Spain. Mm-hmm. Everyone is influenced by cinema, usually, and dance and literature. I think in terms of theatre in Spain, some of the bigger influences in the last few years have been Roberto Bolaño, so literature, and Fassbinder as well was a massive influence for a while. Tartovsky's a massive influence over here. You can see it in the work, that it's just often conceptually more ambitious. Yeah, like I said before, the exchange between of ideas between theatre and dance is constant. So you see work here which is a very different style from work in the UK, and I wouldn't want to see only that. I mean, we've been hugely privileged, hugely lucky to be influenced by both the UK and Spain.
How do you describe your work in this context, in terms of how you actually hold this way of working, which is very particular? And I mean, I'm hearing you really insist on this idea, I'm not a director, I'm not a writer, I'm just an outsider. I mean, what do you call yourself in the Spanish context? And are you bothered about your mode of authorship not really fitting in with that?
I think actually, in a funny way, it's easier over here. I think because we definitely amongst companies who we would consider our contemporaries, the types of companies over here we get bracketed in with, in this weird space in between theatre and dance particularly, but between theatre and other art forms, theatre and performance art as well, and there isn't the same playwriting tradition that there is in the UK, and that very defined way of working, which has been shifted around a little bit more recently. I actually think in Spain it's less restrictive, and I think it is possibly it's to do with the bleed over with dance, you know, where within dance the role of the choreographer is sometimes understood to be more fluid, and often the choreographer will also be a dancer in the show. You won't necessarily list the director, you might list a dramaturg, and that will be a slightly undefined role often within the process as well. I think dance maybe accommodates that idea of a fluidity of roles better than theatre sometimes does. And I feel like we're in that same zone in Spain, and that gives us a bit more freedom to feel less like we have to define and be concrete about what our actual goals are. In terms of how we actually credit staff, we've taken to just, we never list a director. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't make sense.
Fantastic. No, this is great. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. And I'm really interested in seeing what you think.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Bye.
You've been listening to Lend Me Your Ears, presented by Duška Radosavljević, curated by Flora Petrolo, and produced by Tim Bano. The Lend Me Your Ears podcast is part of Oral Dramaturgies, an AHRC leadership fellowship held by Duška Radosavljević at the Royal Central School of Speech and Drama.